All right, today is the 13th of May, then, 2015, and we're in the lower level of the Concord Free Public Library. I'm Carrie Klein, here with my partner and husband, Michael Klein, and would you introduce yourself?
I am Rebecca Sheehan Purcell.
Okay, and your date of birth for some perspective? If you're comfortable.
October 7th, 1941.
Tell us about your people and where you were raised.
My people. Let's see, before Concord, all right, I was born in Morgantown, West Virginia. My parents moved to Arlington, Virginia, just outside Washington, when I was in the fourth grade. And I grew up there, graduated, went to college in South Carolina. And then returned to Arlington. I met my future husband, who was a Concordian, as it turned out, in Washington, D.C. He was working there, and I was at the time. We were married for we married in 65, and then in 73, we moved back home for him to Concord. It was Memorial Day, so it'll be 42 years this coming Memorial Day.
Wow. Talk about the Concord that you arrived in. Everything you can remember.
Well, it's interesting because I, having grown up in what was not officially, but a small city, Arlington, which nevertheless had a lot of colonial history around it, I feel like, in a way, I was just coming home because, although more so, because it really is a small town, or it was a small town then, and it still retains that character. And I do remember, because it was on the cusp of summer, it was a delightful time of year. I enjoyed lilacs, which I had never really seen before. It was just a whole new experience, in a way. It's funny, it was a continuation of an experience, and yet a whole new experience for me. Because of my interest in history, shortly after after we moved here and we got settled, I went to the Old Manse because I wanted to see if I could get a job there on weekends. I actually had a full-time job working for a podiatrist here in Concord, two podiatrists, and but I wanted to become more immersed in the history of the community, and of course that's a lot of that is colonial history and literary history. So I went to the Old Manse, and they didn't have a position open, but the director there said, "Why don't you go try the Orchard House? They may have an opening." The Orchard House is also known as the Louisa May Alcott House. It was her home during her stay in Concord. And so I went there, and they had an opening. And so in August of 73, I started a 16-year adventure, being a tour guide on weekends at the Orchard House. And that was an extraordinary experience that opened me my eyes to Concord's literary heritage as well as its Revolutionary War heritage. So I sort of jumped into that area, and then life, it's funny, I don't remember quite so much about, I just know I was often quite busy. I did not have as many activities outside the home at that point because my husband and I, because I still had my husband, but we parted ways in 1978. And so I was on my own after that for 22 years. And my schedule opened, as it were, even though I was working full-time in Concord and later in Boston. I had this time to be able to become more involved, and so I did.
Wow. In the Orchard House?
The Orchard House. Let me give you a little background here, or as far as what has made Concord so interesting to me. I have always been interested in medicine. My first job was as a dental assistant in a work release program from my high school. And when I came up here, as I said, I worked for a podiatrist for a year, two podiatrists, and then Emerson Hospital had an opening in their outpatient department. So I went there, worked for them, actually became supervisor of the department. And then in 78, I believe it was, I'm not sure, sorry, I should have checked my dates on this, but perhaps the early 80s, I went to work for the organization or company that provided the doctors for the emergency room there. And so we set up an office, and I managed that office. And then the company more or less dissolved. It was taken over by the hospital, so it came under that umbrella as opposed to being a separate organization. Not to get too much into detail here, but anyway, so I went to work for a doctor's group briefly, and then I had this opportunity come up to work for the New England Deaconess Association.
What?
New England Deaconess Association. Well, what is now Deaconess Abundant Life. It is a combination. At the time, it was a long-term care facility plus a home for retired ministers and their families. It was next door to the hospital. It is now, it evolved into a one of the first retirement communities, Newbury Court. But it still retains the long-term care facility, and it has an Alzheimer's unit. We didn't have all of that at that time. I was there during the bridge. And I was there for, I can't remember, I think 3 or 5 years. Again, my apologies. I should have written this down. An opportunity came up for me to go to work in Boston. I worked briefly. I was transitioning between New England Deaconess and what turned out to be the job that I really loved. And that was, first of all, I had a transition job with the Department of Anesthesia at MGH. And then I had an opportunity to go with a biotech firm known at that time as Genetics Institute. It was later taken over by Wyeth and is now Pfizer, as happens in the biotech world. But it was a marvelous experience. Again, in a sense, medical, because it... I liked the company's motto. It was harnessing the body's power to heal. And so I was the executive assistant for a project management team, two-person, and they were developing a protein that would stimulate bone growth. And so for people who had fractures that would never heal together or spinal issues, mandibular problems, this protein was being developed so that they could, so that it could be used to help the body grow these stem cells into bone cells. Absolutely amazing. I mean, and that was only one area. I mean, the whole company was operating on different things. They came up with probably the first factor VIII drug. And factor VIII is the protein or the material that is missing in a hemophiliac's blood that enables them to clot whenever they have a cut. And so the company, after 10 years of research, they were able to get approval and to market this drug. And I'll never forget the celebration because at that we had probably three or four hemophiliacs who now knew that they had a chance to live a normal life and not worry about getting bloodborne diseases because, as you know, they oftentimes have to have a lot of transfusions. So that was really exciting. And I was there for 9 years, and at the end of that time, I married my current husband, and that was in 2000.
His name?
His name is Elmer M, as for Marion, Purcell. He was an Arkansas native, still has the twang.
Marion, M-A-R-I-O-N?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he and his first wife, who was a Sherburne native, I believe, lived here in Concord. I was friends with them for 20 years, and then she died, unfortunately, of a form of cancer, bloodborne. He was an internist in Concord. That's how I knew him, because of the medicine. And I knew her through other circles, actually through the library, among other things, because she was on the Board of Trustees here. But anyway... That was 2000, yes. So we've been married. We'll be married 15 years this September 9th. So, so that gives you an idea of where how I was interested in medicine. And now for the history, it's just been pure pleasure. Can we cut for a minute? So I've given you an idea of what one of the areas of that drove my life was, and what why I pursued the course I did when I was in Concord, at least while I've been in Concord, at least medically. Oh, and I forgot to mention, I also am a volunteer in the emergency department at Emerson Hospital. I've been doing that for probably 12 years. And that's something I really, really find fulfilling, to be able to help people in a very stressful situation. And I don't have problems with the guts and gore. I just never have. So so I'm still keeping my fingers in the pot, as it were.
Talk a little bit about that. What do you do in this capacity?
One cleans the rooms after patients have left.
As a volunteer.
Yeah, as a volunteer. Now, when I say clean, it's more the superficial. If, for example, there were a patient who had a problem that required precautions, what they call precautions, then they would call in housekeeping to do a complete clean of the room. But what I would do is come in, change the sheets, alcohol everything down. You know, we'd have these disinfectant wipes. So I'd just clean everything that a patient would come in contact with there. Then I would make up blood sets. These are blood tubes, and they have sets that they call that they take in whenever a patient comes in and blood work is required. Help to bring in patients when they arrive, if one needs to go out and get them in the waiting room. The job also involves transporting patients to CAT scan, X-ray, to the floor if they're admitted. A lot of times it's just being a smile and a reassuring voice. They oftentimes, because of the tests involved, patients have to wait a long time. And not only for that reason, they could be very busy. It's really funny because I was on the other side of the fence just recently. I had a freak accident at home, and I had a flap laceration of my finger. This happened at 10 o'clock at night, doing something stupid like taking the metal strip off of a box that had, you know what I'm saying. Anyway, so I drove myself to the hospital. My husband was in bed. I drove myself to the hospital. I was there totally for 5 hours. It took them 3 hours to get to me because the place was a zoo. It happened to be one of the busiest nights. And then they were able to get me in the room, and even then it took that much more time. The good news is I can understand why. But for patients, other patients who are not knowledgeable about what happens in an emergency room, it can be very stressful. And so one of the jobs of the volunteer is to help them understand why things take the amount of time they do, and also to reassure them. It's just it's a mixed bag, but it's important. And I always take a batch of ginger snaps in that I had this recipe that was in the Boston Globe some years ago, and the woman who wrote the article said it was the best ginger snap she had ever tasted.
Do you remember it?
Yeah, it came from a woman in Charlton, it's got a stick and a half of butter in it, so right away you know it's good. and all the usual stuff, molasses, ginger, cloves, and cinnamon, and of course the flour and some sugar. But the beauty of it is it's a soft ginger snap. It's not the hard, crackly kind. And so it's a real cookie. And the taste is, I couldn't, every time I make that, people want the recipe. And so my feeling, something that I felt was equally important to everything else I did in that emergency department, was to make the staff feel good. Because they are frontline there. And a lot of times stuff is coming at them, and it's really hard. And so just by bringing a batch of cookies in, it's amazing what a difference it makes. So I do that whenever, when I go in. I'm on a medical leave of absence right at the moment because I had a health issue this winter. But I'm looking forward to getting back to working with them.
How often were you
going?
It'd
be once a week, a four-hour stint. I tell you, you go home exhausted. But it's very fulfilling, like I said. So, and it's one way I can help get back to the hospital, because it's certainly been a wonderful community hospital. I've always loved plants and growing things. You notice my email address?
What is it?
Dahlia Queen. And that was given to me by my partner. A little backstory here. Back in the mid-80s, I was desperately wanting to have a place to garden. And fortunately, in Concord, we have community gardens. Three of them now. We're going to have a fourth one next year. I obtained a plot at the Hugh Cargill Community Gardens. It's on Walden Street.
What's it called?
Hugh Cargill. It was
Cargill
C-A-R-G-I-L-L. It was called the Hugh Cargill Gardens because it was it's on land that was donated by a 1700s Concord philanthropist, a businessman, and who had a philanthropic bent, and he gave the land for a poor farm, which actually was around the corner, adjacent to the property, the gardens, and then also the farmland, so that any of the poor that lived there could grow their own food. And then over the years, it evolved, and in the early, I'd say mid-70s, actually, a community garden was created. And so that's where it is now. It's a 70-person garden and a 70-unit garden. We have families. We have individuals, you know, all configurations, I might add, which makes it really interesting. The youngest is about, well, if you count the young families, children are about six. And then our oldest is about 82 now. So we have a real age spread and interest. But anyway, when I became involved, there was a fellow Concordian by the name of Jim Catterton, C-A-T-T-E-R-T-O-N. Jim was a unique individual, a botanist by training. He had a business, he was an environmental engineer, had a great love of the land, and but he needed help out there, and so I ended up being his partner. And he's the one who gave me the nickname Dahlia Queen for when I first was thinking of getting email, because early on in my gardening experience, one of our fellow gardeners who loved dahlias and grew them had 20 tubers left over. They look like little sweet potatoes. So he had some extras, and so he gave them to me, and that started me. And I mean, it grew like hopsy, because you put one tuber in the ground in the spring, and in the fall you have a clump of tubers. So you can have, it's like a rabbit, you know. So last year I had 120 of them in, and that was after giving a lot of them away. But anyway.
It grew like what did you say?
Like topsy.
Oh, topsy.
Yeah, that's an old, if you remember from childhood, the story. But
so you were a gardening partner?
Yes, I had him until December of 2013. Jim had Hodgkin's disease as a young man, had been treated for it, and was cured. That type of lymphoma you can be cured from. But unfortunately, the radiation that he had received to help cure it many years later, weakened his stomach, and he developed stomach cancer. And this was a guy who was a gourmand, terrific cook, loved food, loved, anyway. So he fought that. It was a very quick-moving thing, which was merciful. He was diagnosed in April of 2013 and died in December. And it was, I can tell you, I knew about it. Not many people knew, because he didn't want it to define him. And he was gardening right up to September. Put his garlic in, which, of course, would be coming the next year. And but he finally succumbed in December. And so the gardeners, we worked our way through that. Everybody pulled together. We were able to find a wonderful rough-hewn slab, stone, granite stone, and then a rock that went right with it that provided a foundation. We made a bench for him, and we had it inscribed with a quote that he had made at one point about gardening and what a miracle of life it is. But anyway, because of his death, I ended up having to manage the garden on my own last year. And I can tell you, it almost put me under. But the good news is I have two very capable women who are helping me this year, and the garden is thriving. So we're, you know, that continues. And it fulfills that love of gardening that I have.
Are we gardening
food, flowers, herbs? That's about, I think that covers it, doesn't it? We don't grow stones. We have enough of those there. You know, someone may have mentioned this to you in the past, but I'm always reminded of a quote that Emerson, it was part of a poem he wrote, and it captures everything. It says, "Would you would know what joy is hid in our green musketaquid, and for the joys and charms that draw us to these meadowed farms." And he really understood, even though he was a philosopher, but he was a philosopher of nature. And I just kind of, and the final line is, "Come and I will show you all." Come, and I will show you all that follows that expression. But it really, it captures the essence of the town. So I must say I've seen a lot of changes from the agricultural standpoint. We've lost our dairy farm. Fortunately, they were able to turn it into a profitable vegetable farm and vegetable and fruit farm. That's Verrill Farm.
Verrill, V-E-R-R?
Yeah, I-L-L, Verrill. And they would be interesting people to talk to if you ever have a chance. I mean, I don't know what if this is ongoing. But anyway, for me personally, because I also arrange flowers. I don't just grow them. I arrange them. I had a floral business on the side at one point. And what I love to do is go and pick things from the woods and the meadows, not on people's property, mind you, but public land, to incorporate them into English-style arrangements. It's very English, actually, to bring in the berries and the various kinds of ferns and things. And I had all my picking sites, but a lot of them are now houses. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little disappointing because Concord has really, it's sprouting houses instead of, not instead of, but it's sprouting houses. And I mean, I understand that because Concord is a very desirable a very desirable town to live in. But I worry that we're going to lose that balance of agriculture and in all its essence, whether it's woodland or worked fields. I worry that we're going to lose that balance between that and the housing. I know of some other properties that are coming on the market, and they're going to be this one old farmer I know of, and I won't identify him because that's not the point, but he's got a wonderful piece of property, and he's in his 80s now, and as soon as he's gone, it's going to be turned into a development. And it's sad, but that's what it is. We are fortunate in that the town does have safeguards. We have conservation restrictions. We have a very active Department of Natural Resources that protects property, town property. So there, it's not something that there is no control over, but it does take diligence to protect it and to have a proper balance. So,
would he have alternatives if the farmer wanted to conserve his farmland?
Well, presumably he could sell it to another, to somebody who wanted to farm it, but it's a little tricky because it's in a family trust, and he's only one member, and the others want to sell it.
Okay.
This is what I know.
So
but that's
conservation trust would not?
No, I'm afraid not. Now, in the case of the Hutchins farm, that land was given they were able to obtain a conservation restriction there. And so they're able to keep that going as a farm, but also to protect the land so it will never be turned into houses. And that's beautiful prime property out on Monument Street. Monument Street is, if you ever go to the North Bridge, the old North Bridge, it's really the North Bridge, but anyway, if you ever go out there, that's Monument Street. It's one of the older streets in Concord, has a lot, and it's kind of the it's a very desirable address. So that, I think I've covered my agricultural interest, and then I've always loved history, and what a treasure box of history we have here. You know, from the Musketaquid Indians on down, or the, not Musketaquid, but were they? Maybe it was Miskatonic. Anyway, the Indians that came up with the name Miskatonic. I'm drawing a blank there. But from that history on down to Revolutionary War, and then the golden age of American literary history, so much of that happened here. But it's never been, the beauty of it is that it's never been held too close to the one's chest. The town has shared its Revolutionary War history, its literary history, with people who come to see it, and it's a part of our being here. We realize it. Fortunately, it's not the only reason why Concord exists. It's not like a Williamsburg. It would never be that. We are a living town, as this book would show you. But anyway, I immersed myself in that. Right away, as I said, I became involved with the Orchard House, and I've been involved with them after I stopped working weekends. I was asked to become a corporator, and then I went on the board.
A
corporator. They have a corporation, the Louisa May Alcott Memorial Association, and it's made up of corporators and a board of directors. And so I was a corporator at first. That's a larger group of people. And then they had me come on the board. So I was on the board for, I don't know, 6 years, a double term. And I just stay involved. Every Christmas, I coordinate the decorating of the house for their Christmas program, which is an absolute delight.
Talk about her. What what is beloved about her in your mind?
Well, the fact that she was her own person, the fact that she... Louisa May Alcott and her family, a very interesting family. She was a very, most of the people who come to visit the house know her from her writings. She wrote the wonderful stories about the original one, of course, being Little Women, about her sisters and herself and her family. And with a few embellishments, literary embellishments. But she just had a way of looking at life that, how can I describe it? She had a lot of challenges of her own. She, if you ever have a chance to read the books that have been written about her by John Madison, for example.
Madison?
Yeah, Mattison. He helps describe the relationship between Louisa and her father. They were two very strong personalities. There was a great love between them, but it was Louisa who actually was the breadwinner for the family. And she took on that role early on, as her mother called her duty's child. And she was. She always was concerned about making sure that the family could stay together. Father was often out traveling the country, giving his lectures on his philosophies. And I remember Louisa describing her father as a... like a hot air balloon being held down to earth by strings held by the family. And so this is how he was. But he was essentially a good man. And it's the whole family's interesting. I mean, the mother was one of the first paid social workers in Boston, did a lot of work with the Irish immigrants that were coming to the country at that point. We're talking mid-1800s, when the Irish were coming over as a result of the potato famine. So, but anyway, it's just an interesting family. She overcame serious physical ailments that she came down with as a result of mercury poisoning when she was doing nursing duty. I know I'm back on Louisa again. I'm sorry. But Louisa volunteered as a nurse during the Civil War and went to what is now Georgetown University Hospital in Washington, D.C., and did nursing duty there, but came down with pneumonia, and they treated her with calomel or something like that, which contains mercury.
Calomel?
Yeah, calomel. It's just one of those medicines that they used back then. And as a result, she ended up with mercury poisoning, and she complained of aches and pains the rest of her life. And this is a woman who was 39 years of age at that point. So, but she rose through all that, and her writings all happened after her books for which she is known happened after that. So, just
you say
really
she was
interesting.
A breadwinner before that. I mean, what did she do to be a breadwinner?
She'd write pot boilers. You know, and actually some of them are quite good.
Hot boilers?
Yeah, you know, dashing stories. And I'm trying to, loves, oh golly, I'm drawing a blank right now, but, you know, swashbuckling kinds of love stories, and which were popular then, and she'd do them under a synonym. She'd get paid a few dollars here and there. When the family lived out in Fruitlands, there was a rather abortive experiment at communal living out at Fruitlands in Harvard. They were there for a year, she wrote a satirical story about that. Which I'm sorry, it escapes me at the moment. It would come to me. And she was paid for that. And then she wrote something called Hospital Sketches, and that was based on her experiences as a Civil War nurse. And that really, that was very widely read by families whose sons had gone through that experience. So... that helped, and then the pot boilers, and then she, I believe she was publishing these to Little Brown, the publisher at that time, and they said, why don't you? They could see that there was a gem in there, in spite of all her tendency to be writing these fantastical stories, and they said, why don't you write a story about your family? And so she did, and that was Little Women, and that was a start. So, and she was able to make her family very comfortable in their later years. So, really interesting. But right to the end, she was Duty's child. So, but and not in a bad way. She did enjoy life, but she didn't enjoy the. The fame and the attention that came from her writings, but she enjoyed doing it. So, anyway, there you are. So, that's that. And then I always have loved Sleepy Hollow. Am I talking too much?
No, I just always like to glance and make sure it's rolling.
Okay. Hopefully.
You're doing great. Not near enough. So, Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah, Sleepy Hollow is a wonderful cemetery. It was one of the first garden cemeteries, and it has many of Concord's, from the beginning. Actually, it was formed in the 1850s when the old burial ground filled up that's in Concord Center up on the hill, the hillside burying ground. And so they started the other cemetery, and it's grown. But that's where you'll find most of Concord's citizens, the great and the unknown.
In Sleepy Hollow?
In Sleepy Hollow, yeah. And it's just a wonderful place to walk and to get a sense of history. I'll never forget when I first started walking there, as you come into the gate that's right by where Bedford Street comes into Court Lane. You come in that entrance, and that's the oldest part of that cemetery. And you see this family plot, and there are two big headstones at either end of them, and then there are all these little headstones. And it's all these children who died so young. It just, you know, and then I noticed that after the last one, last small headstone, within a year the mother died. And I would have to think it was, you know, it had to, even though they realized that death was very much a part of their existence back then, it had to be a real contributory factor. There are many nice aspects of the, I mean, there is some humor. There is this one grave that the headstone says, excuse me, who the hell is Sheila Shea? And this woman had this put on her gravestone. It's in the newer section of the original Sleepy Hollow, not the Knoll, but the Chestnut Hollow. And I can't remember what her particular history was, but it's more contemporary, and needless to say, and she had it inscribed on her headstone. So you have all kinds of people there.
She goes on to say,
I think that's all it said, you know, and it's enough to make people wonder. So I was on the cemetery committee at that time because I was interested in the cemetery. They asked me to come on to the cemetery committee because they wanted to form a Friends of Sleepy Hollow Cemetery, a friends group. And since I was at that time chair of the, or president of the Friends of the Concord Free Public Library, they asked me if I would come and tell them how to start a friends group. And so that, through that avenue, I served a double term on the cemetery committee, and I loved it. It was wonderful. And also served on the founding board of the Friends of Sleepy Hollow Cemetery. And they're still going strong, so, which is really great. You know, because cemeteries like that need a friends group, any of these larger organizations. I'm also actually, speaking of friends, I'm on the, I'm a member of the membership and events committee of the Friends of Minuteman National Park. That was an organization started, I think, 2 or 3 years ago for the purpose of trying to bring in funding for that Minuteman Park, especially at the North Bridge, because it needs outside funding. The government can't support it. I mean, they only allow certain. It has a national budget. It has a government budget, and as you know, there are always cutbacks. And so that's where friends groups are really helpful. So that's my, I'm trying to think if I've been involved in any other historical things, but this building, this was one of the loves of my life, and it still is.
What building?
This being the Concord Free Public Library, 129 Main Street. back in 1985, I think it was, a friend of mine was on the board at that time, and they were going to have a groundbreaking for the new addition. This was back, this is 85, or no, actually it was closer to 90, that's right. Whenever it was. It was in the mid to upper 80s. They were going to have a groundbreaking, and it was going to be followed by a big celebration. Asked me if I would become involved in helping with the event. And one of my loves, in addition to flower arranging, is doing events. So I said, sure. And right off the bat, we had What was her name? I want to say Wharton, but that's not right. It's not a major author come. It was a celebration of E.B. White's life, and we had several literary luminaries come. And so I had to set up the logistics for 400 people. So, it was kind of an ongoing thing, fortunately. But it was a great experience, great introduction to the library. I'd used it before as a patron, but, I mean, I'd come and check books out and so forth. But then I had a chance to see the real operation of the library. And I liked what I saw. And so again, through this friend of mine, Melissa Sawfield, who actually, she was on the Friends Board at that point, but she later became one of the trustees of the Library Corporation and then the president of that board of trustees, a dynamic person who did a lot for this library. But anyway, so I came on the Friends Board, and I did that for, I guess, 10 years. And we I was president for 10 years. Actually, I was on it for longer than that. But we were able to develop several programs for the library, a music series. We have a poetry series and a Thursday author series. We sponsored a number of the children's programs, and we did staff development at that time. We would help pay the expenses for the staff to go to the American Library Association meeting, wherever that was in the country. And so there were many ways that we were able to be to do what Friends should do, and that is to help the organization. So that was very fulfilling for me. I did become president for, I think it was 9 years, and then retired. I can't remember when I retired now. It was about maybe probably 6 or 7 years ago.
Help me understand the difference then between the Board of Trustees and the Friends.
And the Library Committee. Yeah, I have to tell you, it's a constant source of confusion for the community. But the Library Corporation owns the actual building, and they are responsible for maintaining the building, doing any renovations, any expansions, and they also help to pay for some of the books. They help fund the book purchases. The library committee is a town committee, one of several that the town has, but its responsibility is also helping to determine budgetary decisions, and they also help with personnel. That's probably the one committee that is the most nebulous, as it were, because they're still feeling their way as to what they do between the library and the town. They, in some parts, act as a liaison, but it's more to do with staff and book purchases, material purchases. The Friends, are like the cheerleaders of the library. And they are an independent group, but of course they operate with the library director and the Library Corporation. But they fund all the books on tape, a lot of the media that's purchased, films, DVDs, so forth. They fund children's programs. They again, have the music series. All of these, the word escapes me, but for want of a better word at the moment, the add-ons, but the enhancements that make the library really special. And so they as I say, they're an independent group. They have two book sales a year, which help to bring in much of the funding in addition to members. The major book sale is coming up June 6th. You get some of the best books you ever saw at this book sale. I'm not kidding. This Concord is a very literary community. We still have a lot of Concord authors here, living authors. We have people who really love to read, and then they donate their books to the library so that they can be resold.
What are they sold for?
Well, it depends. Usually hardbacks, if I remember correctly, and of course the prices have gone up a bit, but a good hardback is $2, one of the larger softbound books is $2. Paperbacks, you know, your little trade paperbacks, they're 50 cents or a quarter, depending. It's a flat-out bargain. I mean, you're getting, and we have a team of book sorters who work the whole year culling all the books that are donated to the library. And they work with a company that will come in and evaluate which books could be sold online so that they're able to get, we've had some amazing collections come in that normally would have gone into the book sale, but that are able to realize a lot of money just by being sold online. So anyway, when you get to the book sale, you're seeing books that have been carefully culled so that you get really top quality books. And it's just amazing. And then on top of that, we have the holiday book sale in early December. And that's where you get the real cream of the crop books. These are books that are in such good quality that you can buy them for Christmas gifts. And that's what a lot of people do. So it's really great. So the library benefits and the community benefits. And that's the whole purpose of the library anyway. It's a community treasure, and it's there to serve the community, and fortunately it does. All the money that the friends bring in, it goes right back into the library in one form or another, so which is really nice. So I can tell you that was a real pleasure for me to be able to do that.
And your friend got you involved then?
Yeah, she was the one who initially got me. You mean Melissa?
Yes. I was trying to remember her last name.
Yeah, Melissa Saulfield.
Yeah.
And that's Saalfield. She and her husband raised their family here. Wonderful people. Wonderful.
This is amazing.
And then over the years, you know, when I've always been attracted to the business community because I think it's in order, again, one of the tensions in the town is not only to have to make it, not only is it a tourist town, but it's also a community that has businesses. And you want to have, a viable business community because they pay taxes like the people in the town pay taxes, you know. And so I became involved with the Concord Chamber of Commerce back in the early 80s. I was co-chair of the Professional and Service Division, which, you know, that particular division had, like, the shop owners and the doctors and the professional and service, if you know what I mean. And that was a really interesting experience because I got to know I was able to put a finger on the pulse of the business community. I really enjoyed that experience.
You just volunteered to do that?
Yeah, that was strictly volunteer. I was representing Deaconess Association at that point. That's how I was their representative to the chamber.
And what exactly is the Deaconess?
Well, it was that... organization is next door to the hospital. It was founded in the early 1900s. It's on land donated by Charles Emerson, who was one of the early Emersons, many Emersons in the town. And it was provided so that buildings, a community could be built for the deaconesses who worked, who worked at the, I believe it was the Deaconess Hospital, actually, in Boston at that point. Then it became a retirement home for the same. And then they developed this, because it's a Methodist heritage, has a Methodist heritage, they would have retired Methodist ministers. They would provide a place for them to live. And then in addition to a place for the deaconesses, they gradually developed assisted living for retired people, a modest operation at one point. And then as part of that continuum, they developed what became a level four, in addition to the assisted living, a level four nursing home. And back in the mid-80s, made the decision to develop the life care community, Newbury Court. And that was one of the first ones in the eastern Massachusetts area. It's really, and it was beautifully done and something you could be very proud of. And then since then, they have developed another a building that is also, they enlarged the Newbury Court community. And they created what they call the Gardens, which is a unit, very well thought out unit for Alzheimer's patients. And so you have all of that going on there. Actually, the assisted living part, that early operation where they had assisted, that was gradually phased out because they have the continuing care, as it were. So that somebody living in Newbury Court, if they ever get to a point where they need more assistance, they have that available there. And then for serious illnesses or end of life, it would be, or really managed care, it would be long-term care, a nursing home. So.
And that's who you were representing when you joined the
chamber? Yeah, I was working in the accounting department at that point. I was managing it, as it turns out. But they needed a representative, and of course, I was curious.
And then went on to be president.
I did it. Oh no! No, I was just a co-chair of one of the divisions, and that was the professional and service division. Yeah, no, I wasn't. Oh, no.
But still.
No. Uh-huh. Now, I had mentioned that I was on a cemetery. I've been on two town committees, actually, the cemetery committee, and then because of this whole idea of the interest in history, I went on the Public Ceremonies and Celebrations Committee. And I served 5 years on that. That committee is responsible for putting together the Patriots Day Parade, which happens every April, and then the Memorial Day exercises, including a parade, two ceremonies, one in the morning in West Concord, and then one in the afternoon in Concord Center. And then in the fall, a flag retirement ceremony at Sleepy Hollow Cemetery. A very, very interesting ceremony where they give flags that are no longer usable a dignified ending. And that's right at the foot of Authors Hill, which is where all the major authors are buried in Sleepy Hollow. So it's kind of interesting. It's a great setting. And they have the Concord Battery firing there. So it's all very, very special. The Public Ceremonies and Celebrations Committee had been approached by, actually by my husband's first wife, Peg Purcell, Marguerite Purcell. She had been a town selectman and also very involved in the community. But she wanted to have some kind of a 4th of July celebration. And so she came up with this idea of a picnic in the park. And that that was designed to be an opportunity for families, anybody who was in town on the 4th of July, give them a chance to celebrate. And as it turned out, the Public Ceremonies and Celebrations Committee did not feel they could also do that. So Peg worked with the Emerson Hospital Auxiliary and some others and came up with this wonderful idea. This was back in the, I think I wanted to say mid-70s. And it started behind in the parking lot behind Alcott School, and then was moved, because it became so popular, it was moved over to Emerson Field, which is a large, wonderful field in Concord Center. It has now, I mean, over the years, it has had a running track put in. It has a family swimming, recreation department swimming pool. And it has at least three baseball diamonds for youth baseball. And then it has this wonderful alley of trees that you approach it from Everett Street. And it's a pathway, an alley, and it has all these wonderful trees on either side. And at the far end of it is a flagpole that was sponsored by the James Mansfield Post American Legion in memory of soldiers who had fallen during World War II. And that land had been donated by the Emerson family. So anyway, they came up with this plan, and it has gone on ever since, where nonprofit organizations only can come in, set up a booth. They can sell food, they can have games, all kinds of entertainment. They now have a moon bounce. They have the fire department participates with a mock fire, you know, for kids to be able to hold the real hoses and put out the fire, as it were. We get a hot air balloon and so forth. Anyway, I became involved in 1994 and ended up chairing the committee for that for a number of years, It's a wonderful down-home kind of feel. I think we've only had two rain dates in all the years, and it's drawn several thousand people over the years. An average turnout would be maybe 1,000 to 3,000 people, depending. They come and go throughout the day. It starts around 11:30 with the kiddie parade, and wraps up at the end of the around 4:30. The Concord Band comes and plays every year all these wonderful patriotic songs and other songs, and it's just really wonderful. And they finish playing at 4:30, and that's it. But it's just a really wonderful way for people to enjoy a very local, quaint type of activity, you know, with a few flourishes. So I mentioned the flagpole. When my husband and I, the first husband and I, were living near the playground, The flag at that time was maintained, was raised and lowered by a local pediatrician by the name of Dr. McDonald. And he was a very patriotic kind of person. He came up with a really interesting little program. It was called Lest We Forget. And he contacted families in Concord who were responsible for usually a week at a time raising and lowering the flag at Emerson Field and also at Rideout Playground in West Concord. There's a nice flagpole there. And they would each, they would have a daily log, and they'd make a note, you know, if there were anything in particular that day. And to read that log, it's absolutely amazing, the things that happened over the years. And then at the when the family finished its duty, as it were, they were given a card that said, Lest We Forget. And it was a thank you for their service, and their name was put on it. And that went for many years. And then people's lives got so busy. And Dr. Mack ended up doing a lot of the actual flag raising at the Emerson Field. There were local people in West Concord who took care of that field, that flagpole. But Dr. Mack became ill, and he had also been a Concord Minuteman, and my husband was a Concord Minuteman. So he asked my husband if he would help him out with the flag. And and Dr. Mack eventually died. He had colon cancer. And so my husband took it over full time. And then my husband and I, after we parted ways, he moved out of Concord, and I ended up doing the flag. So this was like 1978, I think it was, 78, 79. And I would go raise and lower it every day and, you know, do the half-staff duty whenever that was necessary. And I loved every minute of it. I can't tell you, being out in the middle of that field, and you have to see it to understand, to appreciate what I'm saying, but to be out in the middle of that field and have it ringed by homes, because it's on the north side, it's, I think it's north side, whatever. So on one side, it's Stowe Street. Everett Street.
Stowe,
S-T-O-W.
And then Everett?
Then Everett, E-V-E-R-E-T-T. And then Everett goes down to Thoreau Street. And then over here it's houses, but on all the streets too there were houses on the opposite side of the street, and it's just magical. I don't know how to explain it, and it might sound corny, but I just really love doing that.
You are a phenomenon. You are.
Well, it's you know. I gotta tell you.
How many lifetimes are you talking about?
Yeah.
I've never heard of anybody who did so many things.
Well, but you see, I was alone, and I have a high energy level, and I have a great love of this town. You know, this community, and this is important, it is a community that is like a tapestry. And if I could be one of the threads running through that tapestry, you know, that was always my goal. But I'm not the only one. And this is one thing that's so important in this town, that we have people who care enough about the town. And fortunately, we still do. But you were asking about changes. One of the other changes that is troubling to me is that we are losing our volunteer community. And it's for several reasons. Number one, the volunteers of my era are starting to die off. We have a lot of people in this community who live in enclaves, as it were, and their lives are focused on Boston or elsewhere, and they're not quite tuned in to what's going on in the town. That doesn't mean they don't appreciate the town. They love the town, but for very different reasons. And it's a real challenge to get new volunteers. Now, I will say I'm very pleased to see that. Well, one of the problems with getting volunteers is that you have, because of Concord Schools, you have a lot of people moving here for the schools. And those people are really busy raising their kids and getting them through school. And that's true. I mean, that's just, you know, it's a fact. And rightly so. Their focus should be their family. But if they're not doing work with the schools, I mean, they're doing work with the schools, and as a result, they don't have time to do work on these other things. But I am starting to see some new blood coming into the picture. And a lot of these are women whose children are graduated. And so they can be more involved now. And that's really, that is critical because you have to have, in a town that is so volunteer dependent, whether it's the committees of the town, whether it's even the Board of Selectmen, they're not, they, quote, get a salary, but they don't take it. They turn it back in. And at least that's what I understand. And the committees, those aren't paid. But you've got to have those people who care enough about their community and who can give the time to make it work. I mean, all these boards and committees, if we didn't have volunteers, it would be a very different town. And that's been one of the pluses of the town, even though we've gotten a lot more. The town's grown. It's a bit more sophisticated, although it still has that balance of down home, of caring about local things. There's a big locavore community here, and there's a growing your own food and knowing where your food comes from, and we have a new restaurant in town called Woods Hill Table. Their food comes from either local sources or their farm in New Hampshire. They know where their food comes from, and I got to tell you, I can't get a reservation. This place is so popular, and that's wonderful. Wonderful. It's in West Concord. Took over the old Mandrioli supermarket when they retired. And
I wonder
what
that place might be doing.
Yeah. They had to jump through a lot of hoops to take, you know, because parking was a big issue, and it's always going to be a big issue in West Concord. But they were able to meet all the criteria, and now they're open, and they are going gangbusters. And I say, God bless them. You know, because another thing, a good change for Concord is that we're finally getting some decent restaurants. I mean, we always had the local, you know, the Colonial Inn for the tourists and the adventuresome local person. And you'd have Helen's, or you'd have, you know, the small. And Helen's is great. We always needed a decent restaurant, and it's taken a number of years, but now we've got Bon Dier. B-O-N-D-I-R. It's a play on the name of the chef owner, Jason Bond, who has a restaurant in town in Boston, in the Boston area, very successful. And he came out here and was able to launch an equally successful and really thoughtfully designed and run restaurant. Now we have the Woods Hill Table, and shortly we're going to have the Salt Box, which is it will be a storefront, a retail or storefront takeout, I think, primarily. But it's an effort that was developed by Ben Elliott, who owns Salt Box Farm, which Ben was a chef at some big place in Boston before. And his grandparents lived off Westford Road, an assault box house.
In Concord.
And after his grandparents were gone, I'm not sure how the complete evolution of it, but he now has a catering and a farm operation there. And he has a separate building that is, it's an old building, and he has cooking classes. He does a lot of catering, and he's top-notch. Well, now he's developing this other outlet. So it's exciting to see, because we're seeing a gradual... I mean, we have people with sophisticated food tastes in this town. They're used to being... I mean, a lot of them are Boston-oriented. They're used to good restaurants, and so... Finally, we're getting some decent restaurants here, and it's really great. And even the smaller places they have upgraded. So it's kind of had a ripple effect.
You are a walking, talking, breathing chamber of commerce on the move. This is fabulous. You've given us a wonderful rundown of all the special developments that are going on right now, just when people might have thought there was nothing left to develop. But this is great. All these details of history, food, literature, all these things that you've covered are
cultural
fabulous.
Arts.
Sorry?
I forgot the cultural arts. Okay. Do we have time? Yes.
We have a couple of minutes.
3 or 4 minutes.
Okay. Are seeing a, let me back up. How can I say it quickly? I've been also on the board of what's called FOPAC. It's Friends of the Performing Arts of Concord. It actually, it's had a name change now. It's going through a name change, 51 Walden. It is a, used to be an armory, a drill shed.
An actual drill shed,
and it was turned into an armory for the Civil War and First World War and so forth. But now it's the home of the Concord Orchestra, the Concord Band, the Concord Players, and actually the Concord Players were the first ones to really transform the building. It has one of the oldest wooden stages in the Boston area theater stages, and it has a dance studio, and it's a cultural arts center, very lively. We also have the Emerson Umbrella, which used to be the old Emerson High School. It was turned into an arts a place where artists could come in and have their own little studios, be former classrooms. They are going through an amazing evolution themselves. It's now the Umbrella Center for the Arts, Umbrella Community Center for the Arts. They've had a name change. And they are just going gangbusters. It's thrilling to see. In West Concord, one of the son of a longtime real estate commercial real estate owner, John Boynton. His son, John
Boynton,
B-O-Y-N-T-O-N. Okay, the father?
No, the son.
Oh, good. Yeah, did he tell you about Artscapes?
Yeah.
Keep
good.
Going. Yeah.
That was a wonderful idea, and that's opened up a whole new area for West Concord.
What is that?
It's a series of artist studios. And he renovated these old buildings, manufacturing buildings, renovated them. It was a fantastic renovation. And part of it, one of the buildings has these artscapes, this artscape operation in it. It's really wonderful. West Concord's going through a lot of changes right now, and they're struggling to maintain a certain character, but also to make the community to keep it functioning properly, because they have a new high-rise retail apartment complex coming in, huge. It's being built as we speak, and there is great concern about the traffic pattern there, because already West Concord is an alternate route for Route 2 to get through the Concord Rotary, which is a legendary nightmare. But anyway, at least the people are, there's a committee for that, the West Concord Committee, Study Committee, and there's a later iteration of that. They're working on the problems. They're not just throwing up the hands. They just take it on as a challenge. And that I think, is one of the defining characteristics of this town, that they don't give up. They just find solutions, and they work at it. So, who wouldn't want to live in a town like this?
Perfect conclusion.
Perfect conclusion. Thank you so much.
Thank you.